You know, for 43 years of his adult life, Edgar Cayce demonstrated the uncanny ability to put himself into some kind of self-induced sleep state by lying down on a couch, closing his eyes, and folding his hands over his stomach. This state of relaxation and meditation enabled him to place his mind in contact with all time and space. From this state, he could respond to questions as diverse as, what are the secrets of the universe? How can I remove a wart? His responses to these questions came to be called readings and contain insights so valuable that even to this day, individuals have found practical help for everything from maintaining a well-balanced diet and improving human relationships to overcoming life-threatening illnesses and experiencing a closer walk with God. Now, we have, now Edgar Cayce, by the way, died more than 60 years ago. We have a little bit of his audio of Edgar Cayce that we want you to hear. I mean, it's kind of scratchy. I'm telling you, it's very old, but for most of you, this could very well be the very first time you have heard the voice of Edgar Cayce. I don't even know if it was in his trance state or whether he was just talking. It may have been both, but just listen closely. We're just going to play it for a little bit because it's really scratchy, but it's the voice of Edgar Cayce.
Any stimuli to expect that am stimuli that make for the circulation in any portion of the body may clarify, as it were, the cobwebs or cloud form, the circulatory activity to the brain, which...
All right, so there you go. That's the voice of Edgar Cayce. You know, the majority of Edgar's readings deal with health maintenance and the treatment of illness. Even to this day, individuals have found physical help from information given him as long as 100 years ago. Just an absolutely incredible story. Yet, although best known for this kind of material, he also really dealt with dreams, dreams interpretation, psychic phenomena, ESP, Atlantis, just amazing things. In a moment, James Mullaney joins us. He is the author of Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos on Coast to Coast AM. James Mullaney is an astronomer, writer, lecturer, consultant. He's the author of several books on observing the wonders of the heavens. He's logged more than 20,000 hours of stargazing time with the unaided eye binoculars telescopes. Formerly the curator of the Buell Planetarium and Institute of Popular Science in Pittsburgh, and more recently the director of the DuPont Planetarium, he served as a staff astronomer at the University of Pittsburgh's Allegheny Observatory and as an editor for Sky and Telescope, Astronomy and Sky and Star and Sky magazines. His 50-year mission as a celestial evangelist has been to celebrate the universe, to get others to look up at the majesty of the night sky and personally experience the joys of stargazing. And he's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, James, welcome to the show.
There you go. Actually, it's evening your time. It's great to be on the show, believe me.
Well, I got to tell you, this is great for me for two reasons. One, I'm a tremendous fan of Edgar Cayce.
Wonderful.
But I also love your background and what you've done. And if we have some time, we'll talk a little bit about that, too. And some of these incredible celestial events, James, that seem to be going on. How did you...
May I say right up front that I consider both you and Art Bell to be two great icons of quality radio talk show broadcasting, and I'm quite honored to be on the show with
you
tonight.
Well, thank you, James. How did you, an astronomer, get involved in Edgar Cayce?
Well, I've been invited to speak at the ARE, the Association for Research in Enlightenment in Virginia Beach. Going back at least 25 years now, I've been speaking for them, and they came after me to do a program on the search for extraterrestrial life. The program was called We Are Not Alone, and they've repeated that many times with Dr. John Mack from Harvard and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, many other big names, and that I was happy to do that. Certainly interested in the subject, and tremendous interest in the possibility of life existing elsewhere, and that got me to start looking at who Edgar Cayce was, what his readings entailed. So I had a long interest going back that far. But it wasn't until I started working on this book that I looked at I actually looked at all 14,000 readings on CD-ROM, looking for things related to cosmology, astronomy, physics, anything like that. and had a tremendous revelation. And when I did, I'll be telling you about some of the incredible things that are in the readings that even Casey fans seem to be unaware of.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. I have had so much respect for him. You know, when I was younger, way younger, 57-year-old now, James, but I would read a lot of these Edgar Casey stories and books, and I was just mesmerized by what he did. I was mesmerized by the things he said, and I looked for holes. I looked for reasons not to believe it, and I couldn't find any.
Yeah, the skepticism is good, healthy skepticism, and it's interesting, George. It's many people came to Virginia Beach to expose him as a fraud, a hoax, ended up being becoming believers, if I can use that term, and ended up having readings done for themselves and also writing biographies of Casey.
I think eventually, too, James, it was the tremendous amount of readings that finally did him in. Didn't he just basically die of exhaustion?
Yes, he worked himself to death, basically, and it was during World War II, and you know, so many people wanted readings for their loved ones over there, the servicemen, and he was advised by his doctors and his own readings to you know, back off. And he couldn't stop. He just kept going, and he ended up having, you know, I guess it was a nervous breakdown. At least it destroyed his health. But he gave everything he had to the world.
Tell us a little bit about your background, beyond what I just read.
Well, and thank you for the nice introduction, George. May I say that I'm just a humble stargazer, and you know, as an astronomer, I'm sure you will agree, as an astronomer, you can't have a big head. When you look out and see the vastness of the universe, it sure...
It humbles you, doesn't it?
It humbles you, as my late friend and mentor Carl Sagan said, it gives you that cosmic perspective. So, actually, I became a stargazer at the age of 8 when an uncle came over to visit our house and gave me and our whole family a view of Jupiter and the moon through the telescope, through his telescope. I was so excited at what I saw that I started running up and down the streets, pounding on neighbors' doors, saying, "You've got to come out and see this." This was the beginning of my career as a celestial evangelist. I'm very evangelistic about people seeing the universe. I built my first telescope when I was... 16, I guess it was, and teaching at the Buell Planetarium at that age, and also volunteering at the Allegheny Observatory. Later, I became staff, you know, paid staff members of both places. But although I've worked professionally, both in research and teaching, I'm basically a popularizer of astronomy, just spreading the word that we all got to look up, especially given the state of the world today.
Is that why you're basically called the celestial evangelist?
Yes, and if those that have heard me at my lectures know that I'm one fireball. I'm very quiet otherwise, but I really get on fire. And yes, that's it. Everybody needs a look at the universe. As Robert Frost said in his poem, The Star Splitter, every town needs a telescope.
Invite me to any of your lectures if you happen to be in St. Louis or Los Angeles.
I would love to, George. It's pretty dynamic. It's not me. Something really takes over. And you see these awesome images from the Hubble and other instruments, the space probes. And it's just a rapid-fire journey through the cosmos.
You know, that Hubble photograph where it was aimed into the, you know, darkness of space.
Oh, the deep, yeah.
Oh,
deep
my space. Gosh. Unbelievable. Yeah, and, of galaxies.
Well, George, that's the amazing thing. They pointed to Hubble for 100 hours, which is an incredible feat when you think about it. They were pointed at a piece of sky as big as a sand grain, and they not only kept the Hubble pointed at that speck, but they kept imaging it for 100 hours. That was the initial deep space image,
yeah.
Okay?
And with the naked eye, you couldn't see anything, James, right?
Oh, not at all. It was a totally empty piece of sky. On that one speck of sky, they picked up 3,000 galaxies. Well, George, guess what they've done now? They basically went inside the sand grain, did a 1 million-second-long exposure, and in that speck, inside the sand grain, they picked up 10,000 galaxies.
And how many stars per galaxy, roughly?
It can range up to a trillion. 500 billion to a trillion is pretty typical.
Oh, my gosh.
And all those worlds. And, George, maybe this is a good point, because we're going to be talking about Edgar Casey's stance on life and space.
Yes.
A lot of people misunderstood his initial comments about that. This is very important. And this is not somebody's crazy guess. This was done on a Cray-3 supercomputer. It's been repeated many times. If you were to go to your favorite seashore spot, your favorite beach, and take a big bucket with you and sit down in the sand in front of the water there and start picking up individual grains of sand, if you were to pick up and put in a bucket and count every single grain of sand on all the beaches and all the deserts on the entire planet Earth, you'd be nowhere near the number of stars, other worlds we can see with our largest telescopes. In fact, it's a factor of 10. The latest one indicates there's 10 times as many worlds out there within reach of our telescopes. There's more beyond that than sand grains. So when anytime I'm near the beach, I pick up a handful of sand, just let it trickle through my fingers and think about that.
And because I believe, James, that this soup that I call it exists throughout the entire universe.
It does.
And we're not even into the multiverse yet.
Well, that's incredible.
That,
yes.
That there's got to be this astronomical possibility then that life like us exists out there. Maybe not one of them or two of them. I think millions of them.
Oh, yes. As Wesley Huntress, a former NASA administrator, says, life is a cosmic imperative. I mean, it's everywhere. And, you know, the Thomas Carlyle, the famous writer, said, if there's nobody else out there, what a waste of space.
Hey, poor old Edgar Cayce is probably looking down on us right now going, hey, when are you going to talk about me?
Yes,
this is my
exactly.
show.
Well,
I've got to get you back for a space show.
Okay.
You know, a totally separate space show, because, you know, once I get into this, I'm gone.
And likewise.
And so yep. we'll wheel each other back in here. And talk about, sorry, Edgar, we're going to talk about you now.
He was a patient man, by the way.
And that little audio clip that we just played.
Oh, wonderful. What a way to start the show, George.
Oh, man, that's one of the first times I've ever heard him.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it just kind of gives you chills.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the man, Edgar Cayce. What happened to him? I mean, was he a little boy, James, and something miraculous happened to him, or did he grow into this? Was it genetic? What happened to him?
Well, basically, as a young man, he I guess he started out as a photographer, and he was also selling insurance, and he lost his voice, and not just a temporary loss, but he lost it, and he couldn't sell insurance, obviously. Anyway, a hypnotist came through and hypnotized him, and one thing led to another, and he went into a trance and diagnosed his own illness, came out of the trance. And the amazing thing is, as many listeners know, he never remembered anything he said in the trance. His education never permitted him to know anything about the things he was talking about, particularly when you get into astronomy and cosmology. So a lot of this was never even known at the time, and he was very puzzled. At first, he thought this was something evil. He was a devout Christian. He read the Bible cover to cover every year, once every year. But he came to realize that this is a gift from our Creator. And it is scriptural. Some people have the gift of healing and prophecy. And so he reluctantly started to use it to diagnose initially illnesses, as you said in the intro, and eventually went into many other areas. But that's how he started. And by all accounts, he was just a simple man. He was a gardener, a family man, taught Sunday school. And he really never understood this gift, but thank God he used it.
Also didn't really try to profit off it, did he?
Absolutely not. I mean, if some people hadn't wised him up that he should charge for something to keep going, he would have been destitute. So, no, as so many visionaries, money was not the motivator.
The book is called Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos. Why that title?
Well, it combines, basically, it's Edgar Cayce's readings, all readings related to things related to the cosmos, from basic astronomy to cosmology to physics, quantum physics. And the point was to get folks to read this book and realize there's a whole area of Cayce readings of the 14,000 on readings on 10,000 different subjects, topics. There's an incredible insight that's been overlooked largely. I think because people reading the readings, if they didn't have training in the sciences and weren't into this as you and I are, they would just overlook this and not realize what he was saying. It probably was gibberish, and could be if you don't have an understanding of what's going on today.
His organization, Association for Research and Enlightenment, I was a member of that once. I got to do that again because
yeah.
it is a fantastic organization.
And you've had their executive director, Kevin Tedeschi, on your
yep.
show. And yes, what a light for the world this organization is.
I even had Edgar Cayce on, but I think that might have been his...
Yes.
Yeah.
His grandson. Dr. Charles Thomas Cayce, yes. Or that's probably who it was, yes.
Well, let me tell you, they called him the sleeping prophet because in a trance state, that's how this all happened for him. Now, didn't he have... someone in that trance state, he had a helper, right, on the other side?
Well, first of all, on this side, so to speak, he had either his wife or his longtime secretary actually dictating, taking down what he was saying.
Always by his side.
That's right.
Okay.
And on the other side, he was tapping into what he called the Akashic Records, which he claimed there is a record of every individual that has ever lived, everything they have ever done on the fabric of space and time. He couldn't explain it. Probably the best book ever written on this is by Kevin Tedeschi. It's Edgar Cayce on the Akashic Readings. And gives a tremendous amount of insight to that. But, George, after you see in my particular area the things he was tapping into, there is no doubt that this wasn't some wild thing. He was actually getting information about the universe, unknown at the time. And it's interesting that, and we'll, I hope, get into this, there were things he did not talk about, like black holes, and there's a reason for it. Okay, well,
all right,
hopefully we can get into that.
Absolutely, and I wanted to just also mention, James, that there were seven prophecies that came true. There were others yet to come true. Here's, for example, he foresaw the stock market crash in 1929.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He saw World War II.
Mm-hmm.
This is, again, way before these things happened.
Right.
He saw the shifting of Earth's poles beginning.
Oh, boy. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm. He saw the convergence of communications companies. Might not seem like a big deal, but in those days, nobody ever would have thought of that. He saw the community of people called the Essenes, where we now know the Dead Sea Scrolls originated from. He saw blood as a diagnostic tool, and it is the best diagnostic tool. And he also saw the La Nina El Nino effect as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just an incredible. And we'll also talk about some of the prophecies yet to come true as well. How would you categorize, James, his accuracy? What percent?
Phenomenal. I mean, absolutely phenomenal. There's cases where, for example, he said Earth changes would begin in 1958, I believe it was, and nothing obviously had happened. In retrospect, we're looking back now, we're realizing that some of the things we're seeing today in terms of the Earth's weather patterns and so on actually started in 58 when he said, even though it wasn't obvious at that time. So from my perspective, being a true, probably the greatest psychic that ever lived, he is right on.
I think so.
You notice I use the term is because he is somewhere. I'm going to end this program with a very profound quote about where he is, okay?
Okay, absolutely. You don't think he's reincarnated?
Oh,
I'm jumping ahead, aren't I?
No, yes, okay. He's somewhere, that's for sure, yes.
Probably closer than we think.
Exactly, George.
Akashic Records, what are they?
It's a mystery, and as a scientist, to me, it's a mystery, but there is apparently every action that's taken is a recording, in a sense, is put on the skein, as he called it, or the fabric of space-time, and space-time being infinite, every thought that every individual's ever lived, and according to Arthur Clarke, there's been some 100 billion people that we would consider human have lived on this planet. All their thoughts are there in the Akashic Records, but not only ours, those also of those on other worlds. So how it's actually done, he talked about it in his readings, and there's a section in my book, and it's taken from the ARE Records, about his language, what it meant, by a very famous scholar. So, George, I can't really answer that. I don't know if anybody knows how this could be done, but there's no question that he was, you know, tapping into this incredible
record. And he was somehow able to pinpoint specific things from what could have been volumes and volumes of of this consciousness of records.
Yes, that is incredible. When you think that you know, the thoughts and actions of not only everyone again on this planet, but on all the other worlds is somehow out there recorded somewhere, that he could go right to the an individual's record. It's part of his gift, obviously.
All right, just stay with us, James. We'll be back in a moment as we continue Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, not too far out there, just off the Pacific Ocean. James Mullaney, my guest. We'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So, James, as a scientist, initially you were skeptical about Edgar Cayce. How come?
Well, when you're trained in science, you're supposed to have a healthy skepticism, and everything needs to be supported. But I do want to say, George, that formal training can also, in another sense, blind you to some of the deeper aspects of nature.
I've come to believe,
and people like, again, J. Allen Hynek with UFOs. I was very much like him. As much as I know that we're not alone in the universe. I was initially very skeptical about many of the UFO sightings, but. Nuclear physicist whom you know and had on your show, Stanton Friedman, famous ufologist, said, you're not entitled to a negative opinion about UFOs, and this could pertain to Edgar Cayce also, until any kind of an opinion until after you studied the data. And so most people make snap judgments without really looking at it. So I did look at the data and talked to many pilots. I know many of the astronauts. One of them's a former student of mine, and others, and that quickly convinced me that the phenomenon of UFOs is real. And likewise with Edgar Cayce, it didn't take long comparing his readings with what's going on in science today. Left no doubt in my mind that this is all for real.
Was it one thing, James, about Edgar Cayce that started to change your mind to convince you, or a series of events?
It was a series of the readings, George, and I might as well throw this out right here. To me, the most incredible reading I have found. The readings were given numbers, like the one I'm going to quote is 1900-1. That's the first reading given for to preserve the identity of people he did readings for. They were assigned numbers. So the 1900 person that he did a reading for, -1, and this is absolutely incredible because the reading clearly states, George, get this, that somebody in antiquity had a telescope, and they were using it to study the stars. This is pre-Atlantean.
Jeez.
But the kicker is the telescope, the reading says, which was found. They did not build it. They found the telescope. And the telescope, as we know it, wasn't invented until the early 1600s. This is absolutely incredible. That really turned me
around.
That's
a great story.
Yeah, and what else is in the readings, and that's what really made me
ancients, excited. Ancients found a telescope.
Yes, and the glass which they used to study the stars, and it says which was found.
Means it could have been millions of years older than even them.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, does it tell us, or did it convince you that mankind is much older in terms of high technology for civilizations in the past, or that we had some extraterrestrial visitations, or maybe a combination of both?
I think it's a combination, George, that we don't give the ancients credits for their achievements, but also clearly there's had to have been some extraterrestrial intervention throughout the long history of the human race. So I think it's probably a combination of both.
But in this particular case, I guess maybe we can theorize that millions and millions of years ago, we had some pretty sophisticated civilizations on this planet.
Yes. In fact, I believe this is reported in the Smithsonian, one of the Smithsonian magazine issues, and it's going back quite a while, but a parabolic mirror was found in a coal seam in an Inca ruins. Now, first of all, we couldn't make parabolic mirrors until, again, the 1800s, and whether it was used for cooking or whatever, many have looked at this and believe it was a telescope mirror. It was metal, and early telescope reflecting telescopes like Sir William Herschel used to discover the planet Uranus were all metal. They hadn't gotten to silver and glass yet, but clearly, where did this thing come from? Buried in a coal seam. I mean, how far back do you go in that case? So, it's an infinite universe, and it's an ageless universe, and we're just, we've only come on the scene just briefly. You may have heard this. Again, Carl Sagan initiated this, and it's really amazing that if you represent the history of our planet by the height of the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., recorded history, us, we come along, we're the thickness of one postage stamp sitting on the top of the monument. That's
Jeez.
All. We're just a flash in the cosmic scene.
Well, he's right. Michael Cremo believes that.
Yes.
Civilizations have been millions of years old.
Oh, yes. George, when you look out at the stars, and again, we mentioned that incredible thing about the sand grains, and you're well aware, but maybe some readers are not. When we talk about stars, we're talking about suns. Our sun is a star. It just happens to be our daytime star, the one we are living around. And the number of stars is just off scale. And all those stars out there, are we now know, are being orbited by planets. It's part of the natural birth process, and I'd be glad to go into that if anybody, you think it really, listeners would be interested.
Sure.
But all those stars have worlds orbiting them. So the number of worlds is just infinite.
So we move now into Edgar Cayce and the cosmos, the basis for your work. It is incredible not only to hear his health readings, but when he starts to take it beyond,
yeah,
into the other planes of existence, into the universe, these readings are incredible. So it's the telescope reading really starts to get you convinced, though, that Edgar Cayce could be the real deal. Is that what happened?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I had already been convinced from, prior to that, from his health readings and reading about, hearing about all the skeptics that come, to, as I said earlier in the program, to disprove him, and being converted, realizing that he had this incredible insight. But in my own particular field, this is what really turned me on when I started seeing readings like that.
I got to tell you, I'm a natural practitioner, and I've got an Edgar Cayce book, and he's got all these remedies for ailments,
yes,
and things, mm-hmm, that happen to you, building up your immune system and,
yes,
things like that. I go to his book, and I go and concoct these things.
Yes. He's been called the father of homeopathic medicine, and there's no doubt about it. It's real, you know, and anybody that takes time to look at it and as you just said, do some of these things, they'll find out it's quite real.
So what did Cayce have to say about the possibilities of life elsewhere?
Wow, this is an exciting subject. Of course, it's just generally speaking, it's probably the most exciting topic in science today. Are we alone in the universe? And Cayce is often quoted on a basis of two readings. He was asked, is there life elsewhere? And these two readings have to be taken in context because he was talking about our solar system. I know the one reading says, no, none like us. And he was absolutely right. To our knowledge, there may be life in the oceans on
Europa,
for one, and microbial life, or perhaps even something more buried beneath the sands of Mars and things like this. But he was right. To our knowledge, there is no life like us in the solar system. But he had many other readings that talk about other civilizations and other beings elsewhere in the universe. So those readings are not looked at. It's just the two famous ones when he said, no, there isn't anyone like us. Again, it has to be taken in context. He was discussing the solar system.
Okay, so let's go beyond the solar system. Did he say, mm-hmm, anything about that?
Yes, and he talked about the Stargate, the star Arcturus, which was, he considered, one of the entrances to the center of the universe, as he put it. And he had these out-of-body or sojourn experiences, as did many of the people he did readings for. And he personally went to Arcturus two times, which is absolutely incredible.
In his astral state.
In his astral state, yes. And, George, on a personal note, my dear wife, one of her brothers, was a very promising medical student at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And he was killed, I guess, I forget now how many years, 27, 30 years ago, by a drunken driver, okay? And my wife, intuitively, even before we met, said he went to Arcturus. Now, how she knew that or what, but she's convinced, and I am too, that David went to Arcturus. At least that was one of his sojourns after he left the planet Earth.
Huh.
And it also reminds me of the story about the Pleiades. You're probably aware of this, but many indigenous cultures throughout the world, the Chinese, the Egyptians, the Japanese, who have named their car after the Pleiades star cluster, claim their ancestors came from the Pleiades. And where did they get that idea? And, George, one of the most moving experiences in my life, when I do my evening, my lectures, if they're at night, I always bring a telescope, and it's a really state-of-the-art, sophisticated instrument, so it gives incredible views.
Yeah.
And if it's clear following the lecture, I set up the telescope. Well, one of these was, and this is going back a number of years now, it was outside the New York Open Center in Manhattan. And after the lecture, we had this nice crowd of people out on the sidewalk, and across the street, a woman was walking down, and she stopped and looked at us. And finally, she was kind of apprehensive, but she walked over and she said to me, what are you doing? And I said, well, we're looking through a telescope. Would you like to take a look? Now, she said, I've never looked through a telescope in my life, and I happened to have the Pleiades star cluster in there. She looked in at the Pleiades and burst into tears, and she said, that's my home.
Oh, my.
Now, how did she know that? She had never looked through a telescope before in her life, and but there was a resonant chord there, so it's pretty incredible when you
And wasn't the, I'm pretty sure, the Barney and Betty Hill case, the abduction case?
Yes.
Weren't they from that star system?
They were actually from Zeta Reticuli.
Ah, yes. That's
amazingly,
right.
Okay. It is an existing double star system. You can't see it in the northern hemisphere, but it's in the southern hemisphere, two solar-like stars, which we now know have planets orbiting them.
Well, in this passageway that's out there, what does Casey mean about that?
Well, I don't think he was talking specifically about black holes. In fact, maybe this would be a good time to bring this up. They're as profound as his readings are, and we can get into this a little bit more in cosmology and physics and astronomy. There were things in mainstream news today, like black holes and quasars and pulsars and things like that, that he did not talk about. And the question is, why not? And, George, I think it's pretty obvious why not. Nobody thought to ask him about them. And I'll tell you what, if Edgar Cayce were alive today, you'd find me camped out at the ARE's door. I mean,
oh, man, you'd be talking about dark matter, dark energy,
yes.
Black holes.
Yes.
What are these things?
Yes.
And he'd probably have the answers for
it. Oh, he would. There's no question about it. All this information is there. And even things he did talk about were way, way ahead of his time, weren't in mainstream science yet. But if someone had asked him about black holes, I'm sure he could give him quite a discourse.
You don't think he was then hesitant to talk about them because he was afraid of them or something bad could happen?
Not at all. In that sleeping state he was in, he was fearless. I mean, he was just, the whole universe was being made available to him, and there had to be some excitement even on his part.
How many years would he have been ahead of any scientist?
In some cases, like dark energy, dark matter, probably 50 years. And also, excuse me, so we're talking about the serious Casey, and it often comes up, George, well, did this man have a sense of humor even when he was in a trance state? And there's one reading that somebody supposedly in their one of their sojourns went to Jupiter, and this person asked Casey in his trance state, well, could I speak the Jovian language? I forget how it exactly went, but Casey came back to him and said, if you can read, understand Jovian, yes. I know that's what it was. He wanted to know if he could describe his time on Jupiter. Anyway, there are instances like that where Casey clearly had a sense of humor.
How do we know Casey wasn't a time traveler, a futurist?
Well, I think maybe in a sense he is. You know, George, astronomers are all time travelers.
True.
Because, you know, the further out you look into space, the further back into time you're looking. And Casey made statements like time and space are relative, that they're constructs of the human mind, which goes back to the anthropic principle and all this talk today that we're creating the universe that we view. Our minds are intimately linked with it. So he was a time traveler. I mean, he was going back to Atlantis and early civilizations, and he was looking into the future with the Earth change predictions.
Didn't he try to tie in the relationship between astronomy and astrology?
Wow, that's a whole show. You're not kidding. George, I must tell you, first of all, there's this great rift that's developed between astronomy and astrology. Way back when, they were one and the same subject, okay? Kepler,
right.
One of the world's greatest astronomers, was an astrologer. But they've gone their separate ways, and Casey said, first of all, and he was very emphatic in reading after reading after reading, that the stars do not govern our future. That's one of the basic tenets of astrology, that we have control over our own destinies and that. And there's these incredible stories, not just in the Casey readings, but two people born within minutes of each other. One becomes a mass murderer, the other becomes a brain surgeon. You know, that does not jive with the tenets of astrology
exactly.
Today. And it's pretty interesting, George. There are, we hear the 13 signs of the zodiac, or the 12 signs of the zodiac. There's actually 13. There's this enormous constellation called Ophiuchus, the serpent bearer, and it lies on the ecliptic between Sagittarius and Scorpius. The sun, moon, and planets go through there all the time, and I've never met an Ophiuchan. But the point is, there is some substance to astrology, and an attempt to excuse me, in an attempt to seal this rift, the ARE sponsors, it took me many years to get them to do this, but I'm very grateful to them, they did. And they sponsored a conference in 2004 called Reuniting the Natural Unity of Astronomy and Astrology. And I was the representative astronomer, and Stephen Forrest, who's trained in physics and astronomy, but is also internationally known as an astrologer, participated, and a few others. And we tried to show this dialogue that's necessary between the two of them.
Well, I've got to tell you, you know, this link between astronomy and astrology has some strong points, and we've had both on this program before, as you know.
Right, exactly.
You know, when Casey started looking at physics that we are finding out now,
yep.
How did he explain it, and what kind of terms, James?
Well, for example, let's take the incredible discovery or rediscovery, because Einstein actually predicted this in his early work and dismissed it, of dark energy. And that is this unbelievable, see, the universe, as you know, is expanding, and the galaxies are moving apart, and it was widely believed up until the last 5 years or so that gravity would eventually win. The expansion would stop, the galaxies would all converge into a big crunch,
mm-hmm.
and then it would all start over again.
And
well,
again, yeah,
there's now no question that that's not what's happening. The galaxies are expanding, they're accelerating, they're not slowing down. Some invisible force, which Einstein calls the cosmological constant, is an anti-gravity force, is basically what it is taking galaxies with half a trillion suns and flipping them across the universe at nearly the speed of light. Well, Casey talked about this. He called it the night side forces instead of dark energy. And he discussed in quite a number of readings anti-gravity. So he was already, you know, tapping into this frontier material that we're dealing with today.
So we as a galaxy here in the Milky Way, and then the solar system in general,
right.
Are we too being pushed out into the universe? Are we moving at the speed of light clip?
Yeah. it's interesting. This is where relativity comes in, because the further out we look, we're actually seeing galaxies moving at nearly the speed of light, 99.99% of light, out at the edge where the Keck telescopes, the big binocular telescopes
right.
in Hawaii and so on, are looking. But if you were on one of those galaxies, and to us we seem relatively stationary, if you were on one of those galaxies looking back at us, we appear to them to be moving at the speed of light. So
maybe we are.
Yes, maybe we are. And
I guess things are moving along with us.
Exactly. George, it's kind of interesting, and there's even some things on the Casey material about this, but we are on this planet moving seven different speeds in seven different directions. We are literally space travelers. I mean, we're all astronauts. We've all been in space all our lives. We're on spaceship Earth.
We're made with stardust, aren't we?
Absolutely. Our bodies are made of stardust. And as an example, the calcium in your fingernails, teeth, and bones, the iron flowing through your bloodstream right now, the carbon in all the cells in your body, the potassium in your brain, so you can understand this program tonight, all were forged inside of exploding supernovas eons ago.
James, I know I'm getting old, but 13 plus billion years old? Come on now.
Well, that's the amazing thing. As you look out into the beginning of it all, out into this incredible universe, you feel young again. You feel like a child. And we are, you know, cosmically speaking, we're just children.
So this push with Casey, his ability to foresee these things, absolutely incredible. We'll come back to you at the top of the hour. This was a fast hour, James. I can't believe it.
Okay? We'll talk about time being relative.
Absolutely. We'll be back. We'll talk more. Plus, I want to get into the Hall of Records, too, and see what he said about the Hall of Records that could be at the base of the foot of the Sphinx.